I'm going to start, Chris, by just a few reminders of your...
Of who I am?
Who you are.
For myself.
Of your, yes, no, I'm going to say some nice things about you. That's tentatively how we sort of pick this off. So, Chris, everybody knows this stuff, right? Chris is an acclaimed television writer, producer, novelist. We can say novelist.
We can, it's, yeah, there's a novel.
Say novelist. There is a novel. I think probably it's fair to say Chris is best known for the outstanding TV series Broadchurch and his wonderful time as head writer and executive producer of Doctor Who. But Chris began the TV career in the 2000s writing for shows like Life on Mars, Torchwood, before quite rightly achieving widespread recognition for Broadchurch. But today we are here to discuss Chris's first novel, which is called Death at the White Hart. And it's a mystery novel set in rural Dorset. So Chris, before we dive into the White Hart,
yes.
I just want to go back a little bit and talk to you about where the compulsion for you as a writer come from. Where was that formed? Where does that come from?
Oh, okay, we're going deep early.
Deep.
Oh, why did I want to be a writer? What drew me to write? Is that what you mean? Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know. I mean, I was always really interested in stories. I was always, and some of that comes from watching Doctor Who as a child. Watched a lot of TV as a teenager, and I think, and read a lot as a kid. So I was probably a high-grade story addict early on. Yeah. So, and I was saying to you before, Tim, that actually during some of these conversations I've been having around the book is I'm discovering things I'd forgotten about my reading and influences, and one of the conversations was about goes back to reading Enid Blyton as a kid and going, oh, The Famous Five and The Secret Seven, and those are mystery novels.
They're crime novels.
And I didn't, like until about 3 weeks ago, in Waterstones in Dorchester and Evening Like This, I didn't realise. And so that kind of loving stories, so loving books, I read voraciously, all kinds of things. And then TV was also a big love for me. And I guess, I mean, I don't know, Tim, is the honest answer, but I think the thing I learned from following Doctor Who and being a fan of Doctor Who is there was a job called writer, and I was, you knew who those people were from the magazines, from the behind, there was a making of book of Doctor Who, and knowing that it was a job that you could do sort of sat in me. I thought, you know, on stage, I thought maybe I'd like to be an actor. I did drama at university where we did all kinds of different parts of the drama jobs, did stage management, did directing, lighting, did writing, acting. But once I'd started writing, I don't know, it's like a little bug that stayed in me from childhood. So, yeah.
And who are your literary heroes? You mentioned Enid Blyton, but who else sparked your imagination?
As a kid, Agatha Christie definitely used to get those books out. When I was a kid, once a week from the library, get one, send it back, take it back the next week, get another. Even to the extent I was getting, large, because they didn't have the ordinary ones, because they'd been borrowed, I wanted to work my way through every single Christie, and I would get the large prints, ones that were in the library, as somebody's now told me, depriving somebody who really needed the large print version. I'm just a 12-year-old.
Cross people still out.
Yeah, I really apologise to those people. I'm sure there's some Doctor Who fans here, Terence Dix and the novelisations of Doctor Who as a kid, that they were very important to me. Douglas Adams reading The Hitchhiker's Guide when did that come out? Was that 80 or whatever?
Late 70s.
Okay, so I probably read it about 84, so as a 14-year-old reading that and going, oh my goodness me, it's so interesting now, having gone back and now read P.G. Woodhouse and listening to some of those at the moment, Stephen Fry audiobooks, which I cannot recommend strongly enough. but you go, oh, Douglas Adams is P.G. Woodhouse in space, you know, and so, and Stephen King, massive for me, I would say, between kind of 13, 14 and well, now, but, you know, particularly that kind of late teens, early 20s, I read a lot of his stuff. I think he's an extraordinary writer, continues to be an extraordinary writer.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? I think if he hadn't, if he wasn't known as a genre writer so much, he'd probably be deemed to be one of the great American novelists of his time.
Yeah.
Even more so than he actually is, maybe.
Yeah, and maybe it's one of those things where, because he's so prolific and popular, he makes it look easy, but he's a chronicler of our times and of America in the same way that if you had to take one writer, what's the story of America from the 70s to now, I think you would take Stephen King and go, that's because he's also talking about America's fears and all of our fears, in the same way you would take Dickens for a particular period of British history. So.
Preparing for this interview, Chris, I looked up a number of things that you said about writing.
Oh dear.
And one of the things that really struck me was you talked about you aspire to write with heart and honesty. And I think I get that from the book, but just would you just expand on that a bit in terms of what writing, what does writing allow you to do?
I don't remember saying that, but it sounds right. I can subscribe to it now. I think what it means is, well, I think I write to try and make sense of the world as I see it, and through different prisms. Sometimes that will be through a crime prison, sometimes that will be through a, you know, sort of plays as well, which are sort of main house comedies, and sometimes it's through a comic prism, sometimes it's through science fiction. You're trying to figure out what the world is. Ishiguro has a great phrase about that, saying that the sort of job of the writer, or what a writer does, is really is offering something up, a piece of work which basically is saying, I feel the world is like this, or I see the world this way. Does it feel this way to you? You know, and whether that's a book or a TV show or a play, you know, really that's what you're trying to do. So within that, I suppose what I'm interested in is the people. And so if you talk about heart and honesty, or apparently I talk about heart and honesty, it's, I hope, and particularly with this book actually, I think it really applies to this. It's got the sort of Agatha Christie golden age structure of a murder mystery, of a classic whodunit, but I want it to be about people whose lives are the lives that we all live, and in that they're very recognisable. So what I'm after is characters you can fall in love with, or sympathise with, or empathise with, or understand, or wonder why they're doing the things they're doing, in the middle of a rollicking narrative, you know, which I think is my childhood thing of I'm loving genre. So the genre is the engine, but the vehicle, the overall vehicle of the ride is the people and what's happening to them.
And it is gripping. We'll get into the novel. Just before we do that, because obviously you had this very successful, and you have this very successful TV career, what encourages you to pivot to novel writing? Because they're very different forms, aren't they?
Yes. I mean, novel writing is like being a proper writer, isn't it? It's like, I mean, look at this shop full of amazing books by writers. And it's like, it was a number of things. So when I did Broadchurch, after the first season of that went out, I had lots of offers from publishers to think about doing a novel, an adaptation of Broadchurch or something else. We did a novelization, which Erin Kelly wrote brilliantly. But I really wanted to do it, but I was doing more Broadchurch. Then I went on and went straight into Doctor Who. And coming out of Doctor Who and running that, doing 11 episodes a year, where you were like in 11 different time periods and places and monsters, and coming out of that, you sort of go, oh, what gives you that creative hit? What gives you that challenge as you come out? And so what I wanted to have, knowing that, you know, because I stopped doing that because my kids had a year of GCSEs and A-levels. And in that year, I was thinking, what What's the next creative challenge? You know, what is going to test me? So it's really, I wanted to see, so it was number one on my bucket list. That's the three things I wanted to do. And trying to write a novel was number one, to see whether I could do it. And then take it from there, really. And here we are. Yes. You know, it's like, it's sort of one big accident, but it's a creative challenge more than anything else, first off.
What did the screenwriting give you? What did it bring to the novel writing experience?
I think, hopefully, structure and a sense of pace. Screenwriting is very driven by a narrative. So hopefully a rollicking good story with lots of cliffhangers from all my favourite shows. Hopefully it's a real page turner because of that. I would say, I hope, depth of characterisation and richness of characterisation and enough reveals within the characters as well as the story. And hopefully a sense of place. The sense of place is really important to the novel, just as sense of place is really important in screenwriting. So I think there's that. I think it also, the absence of something in screenwriting was one of the reasons I wanted to do a novel, which is about the internal monologues of characters and writing it from their perspectives, the sort of thing that actors do. We were just talking about this previously. As an actor, an actor can do, and the cliche of working with actors is they go, you give them a page of dialogue and they go, I can do that in a look. You know, and it's sort of, and some of them really can. But really more what it is actually in reverse for a novel, a whole shot of an actor looking into the distance can be a whole chapter of a novel, and that you are playing with past and present and time and thinking and emotion, and you can have a whole narrative within 1 second of a character's life. But what it brought me is, I knew you don't do that in screenwriting, and I really wanted to bring it to the novel. That was one of the great challenges and interests, and one of the reasons that the novel is narrated, or is from the perspective of sort of 4 or 5 characters, the detective partnership, and then at least 4 of the main suspects. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to try that. It was one of the great challenges and joys of writing the book.
Yeah, you do that brilliantly. We're going to come back to some of the stuff about kind of unreliable narrating.
Yeah, I have somebody once bought me a T-shirt which said unreliable narrating. Really, one of my favourite things.
Whet our appetite for the novel, Chris. The people in the audience who haven't read it, just give us the spoiler-free pitch.
The elevator pitch. Okay, this is a long elevator ride. I'm just telling you. So, 2 a.m. On a misty September night, West Dorset, the A35. I don't know if anybody in here has driven. Oh, look at some nods. Driving along the A35 at 2 a.m. It's a man shaking his head. If you read the book, you'll know what it feels like. The guy is driving home 2 a.m. and he encounters in the middle of the deserted, misty A35 an object in the middle of the road, and he gets out of his car to discover it's a body of a man tied to a chair in the middle of the road, and on his head is attached a crown of deer antlers, and the lower half of his body is wrapped in a Hessian sack. And the novel is the story of Nicholbridge, a police officer, a detective, who is a West Dorset native and has been in Liverpool for a couple of decades, being brilliant, and has come back to her native West Dorset, not realising she's been sort of enticed back to West Dorset to run things down there. But when she arrives back, she realises it's underfunded, it's not quite as advertised in the brochure. And she is now confronted with this strange murder, the murder victim is the landlord of the local pub in the village of Fleetcombe, the White Hart of the book's title. And Jim Tiernan, the murder victim, has just had a particularly he's the landlord, and he's had a particularly rambunctious night the night before with a number of people in his pub. And so it's basically, like I was saying, it's a very Agatha Christie-ish, multiple suspect page turny. Did they do it, or did they do it? But set now, and that's the really important thing. I'm sure we'll discuss that as well.
And it's such a striking opening, isn't it? The antlers particularly.
Yeah.
Because it has so many kind of mythic and folklore resonances as well, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's a big part of the novel. There's quite a sort of a folk horror element part of it as well, and those antlers are important, I think. So the sort of nature of West Dorset, the folklore, the heritage, the rural traditions are baked into the novel and are part of the discoveries as we go along.
You mentioned the importance of place, and in Fleetcombe, you kind of reflect contemporary life in the Southwest, really, don't you? I think you
yes.
say quite a bit about the Southwest. I know it's a locale that's important to you, but what drew you to write about the Southwest?
Oh, because I live here. because I live in West Dorset, so I live, pretty much exactly where it's sort of fictional place where the novel's set. There isn't a village of Fleetcombe.
Yeah, you should be really careful there.
Yeah.
Your neighbours will be. Yeah,
they're already guessing. They're already going, where's that village? Is it? But it's actually sort of a compound of a couple of villages. And I think, for people who live around here as well, you will know the sort of village we're talking about, where there's maybe one or two pubs. The post office is probably closed. You'll have a real sense of those communities. I think it's a bit overlooked. I think the southwest of England is a little bit overlooked in terms of how it gets represented within the country. So that's one part of it. And as an incomer to the southwest, having been in Dorset for 21 years, so and been told very clearly when I moved down here, you're not a local until you've been here. I think they said three generations or something. But anyway, it was at least 25 years.
So you're definitely a newcomer.
Yeah, and always will be. Well, my son was born in Dorset, so he's a native Dorsetian. I don't know what that word is. That's how incomer I am. I love it, but I feel like there are specificities which are very different to how you live here, how one lives here in the southwest compared to how one lives in the northwest, where I've lived in a lot of different places, and I've lived in London for a bit, I've lived just north of Liverpool, I've been all over the place in my life, and there's something very precise and important about how people live their lives here.
You're highlighting aspects of the Southwest. Was there anything you wanted to do? I mean, I say this with some trepidation because we're in the Southwest.
Are we Southwest or West in Bath? What do we think?
Southwest.
Great. Home territory.
Thank you
very much, guys. And also, I like that you were very vehement straight away.
There's no ambiguity.
Yeah, that's good. That's what I felt. And then, as I was talking, I was like,
But this is where, again, now I say this with even more trepidation.
Right.
Is there anything that you're critiquing about the Southwest? Is there anything that you're going to put a mirror up?
Well, I'm putting a mirror, but not critiquing, I think. I'm trying to represent how life has changed, and particularly, I think I was really conscious of the difference between when I was writing this and when I was writing Broadchurch, which is now, I was writing that in 2012, so that's apparently 13 years ago. And life has changed a lot, and people's lives have changed, and people's jobs have changed, and the structures of society have changed quite a lot in that time. But it doesn't feel documented to me. In Broadchurch, for example, you take it for granted that there is a functioning police headquarters, and that it's well funded and it's open, and that is not the case where I live, and it's not the case probably where a lot of people live now. So so some of the characters in the novel, the sort of jobs they do, there's a character called Eddie who's in his 60s and he is a delivery driver and he's being tracked by his employer on an app and by the customers who are going, is he here? He's 7 minutes away, where is he? And he doesn't want to be in the job. There's another woman who's running an Airbnb. There's a character who's over here from the Ukrainian Homes for Refugees scheme. There's a character who works in a cash-only barbers. And a lot of those things would not have been jobs and livings 13, 15 years ago. And you sort of read all the big stuff in the papers about tech disruption, how all these things are operating at a global level, but actually the trickle down into all of our lives now. Our lives are unrecognizable in terms of our day-to-day interactions to how they were 20 years ago.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but because in broadsheets, it's quite a big focus on the local paper, isn't there? But those are becoming increasingly rare.
Yeah, and across the three seasons of Broadchurch, it's the documenting the decline of the local paper. Yeah, now if you watch the first episode of that now, there's a point where a journalist tentatively sends a tweet, and it makes it look like a historical document.
You mentioned this already, but I want to get into it a little bit more in terms of these multiple perspectives.
Yeah.
And I think one of the things that characterises your writing is the focus on overlooked voices, people who are maybe invisible or don't have authority or presence. And I think that's important in your writing generally. That felt particularly important to you in this novel. And one of the characters I was talking about earlier I really loved is the schoolgirl Shannon.
Yeah.
So I'd just say a bit about the importance of that diverse perspectives generally in the book.
Well, I mean, I definitely think the book, I think that word overlooked is really great in terms of its description of what I wanted to do with the characters in the novelist, is the lives that don't get talked about or described, or you don't get insight into, but the lives that you know those people. The reason the pub is at the heart of the novel is the characters should be the people you meet down above, down the pub, and giving them, and so there's a seismic event that occurs in their lives, but really I wanted everybody to feel really relatable, and also what I wanted to do is make sure there's a range of characters. So there's a range of characters, all of whom may have some involvement potentially in the death of Jim Tin, and the youngest is 9-year-old Shannon, who we first meet observing things from the hidden top of the slide in the local playground, which has a view over the sort of a lot of the whole village. And yeah, she's a really important character in the novel, but she is overlooked in all sorts of ways. But everyone, I think it goes back to something that we were saying, the difference in jobs and the difference in how people are living. It's like, I suppose right now, so I had somebody say this the other day, and it's like, it's really true. It's like, somebody said, where are the grown-ups right now? And it's like,
They're not in charge, are they?
No, they're not, you know? And it's really like, that's the sort of, the absence of grown-ups within all of our lives, and maybe that it's felt this way for a few years, you know, maybe since COVID, or, you know, discuss. But that's what I'm exploring in this, is everybody is doing their best, but it's tough, and it's causing people stress. You know, there's a lot of stressed characters in this novel.
And I think it's really interesting because exactly that, it almost, you talk about the unreliable narrator.
Yeah.
But Shannon, in a way, brings the reliability of the perspective of a child, because she sees things without a filter in many ways, doesn't she?
She does, yeah. But and I think it's not too much of a spoiler to give away. It's like, she has at least seen something that is relative. But nobody's asking her. Nobody. But I think, so yes, that sense of, but everybody is a bit, nobody's checking in with each other. I guess that's the dissonance as well that I really enjoy with the setting of a sort of quite a closed village, is there's a sense of the cliche of, oh, everybody knows each other. They sort of do, and they do within the novel, and my experience of these places is, and even the place I live is a market town, so bigger than a village, but people do know each other, you do get stopped in the street. But whether you know people or you really know what's going on in their lives is part of what I hope is explored. It's probably a nature of a crime novel anyway, is how characters present versus how you gradually find out what's going on in their lives across the thing, and that's the game and the fun.
It's a great question, do you really know them? Do you really know them? Let's talk about Nicola Bridge, who's your Detective Sergeant character. Really complex, balancing lots of personal and professional challenges. What's the character development process with her?
Well, I wanted a character who felt like she was, again, going through the process is that somebody working, but A, working as a detective in a police force nowadays would, but also somebody who was having to navigate a marriage and having late teenage kids and just trying to figure out all of those things. So what I've tried to do with her is make sure that she's not a one-note character, that she's, you know, she's as rounded again as anybody else, and she has concerns like her, the boundaries between private and work life are blurry, not in an unprofessional way, but in a way that we all take our private lives into work internally at the very least. You don't sort of switch off your life when you leave the house and then go to wherever you go to work. So that sense of she's bringing great expertise, but she is also suffering a bit of a crisis of confidence at the beginning of the novel. So she gets a case that will test her when she's at her most vulnerable.
It's interesting you say that, because I think you did something in my experience that's almost unique. I don't think I've seen, I don't think this is giving too much away. I don't think I've seen a detective's confidence undermined by challenges in their personal life in such a complicated, but actually quite a really compelling way. It's difficult, so I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, because part of that's the story of the novel.
Exactly, but it's a really interesting engagement with things like betrayal. Yeah, it's very. So I'll just say it's really good.
Don't apologise for that. That's good. I think I'm glad it feels that way, and also but she's also great at her job. She's a great detective. That's why she's been recruited. And I really wanted to. She's a great character, but she's also, like we all do, she has moments of doubt, points of doubt. She's suffering from a momentary loss of belief, but she's also confronted with being in an entirely new situation. That entirely new situation is within a place she's had to go back to where she hasn't been for 20 years, and that's got all of its own richness as well. You know, she's coming home, but not really coming home to the place she left, and she's not the person she was. So, yeah, I hope, you know, it's the first, I'm writing the follow-up now, and she is designed to, along with her partner who she meets in book one, so her detective partner, Harry, who is known as Westlife due to his boy band good looks, and that's his nickname on the station. But there, the novel is also the story of their meeting and finding a professional accommodation and the dynamic between them, and that's the dynamic that will go on into subsequent books.
He's another great character, because he's slightly naive, isn't he, Harry?
Yeah, and they both get the partner they don't want and both need, you know, and then they get a case they don't really want but really need. So, yeah, I think it's the thing to say, it's always a weird thing to say about a crime narrative, but it's also, hopefully, it's funny and it's warm and their dynamic is at the heart of that. I wanted to create a really great detective partnership that has a long way to go and that you should feel, hopefully with all the characters in the novel, but particularly with those two, that whenever they turn up, you're like, oh, great. Because there's also lots of bits of them having to hang out in a car together and how they navigate that immediately when they're just starting to work together.
Yeah, overhearing each other's personal phone calls, which is particularly
one of the moments in the novel. Yeah, exactly.
You mentioned crime fiction again there, was it always going to be a crime fiction novel to do? If you were ever going to write a novel, was it going to be a crime fiction novel, Chris?
I think it was, because I love the genre and I know the genre, and I really wanted it. I didn't feel I wanted to write a tone poem of a novel or something, you know, my struggle or anything like that. I fancy doing a really commercial book that people are going to devour in a couple of sittings. That I wanted to write a book that's going to make you late going to sleep, that you're just like, one more chapter and then it's 2 a.m. That's, I suppose that comes back to being reared on cliffhangers, but also that's what I love about a book, is when you think, I can't bear to be away from it. And that's what I was trying to achieve, but then finding the reasons for I can't bear to be away from it is about those characters, is about the twists and turns, is about also the relationship, also the game of, it's the thing I love about murder mysteries, particularly in book form, is you are participating as a reader, you are completing the novel. It's not there and coming to you, it's like you are continually evaluating, sifting, you are the detectives. And I love that too, you have to be active in a murder mystery novel.
I suppose in a way the reader is the collaborators that you have on TV in other forms, aren't they?
Yeah.
Creating the
art. Very much so, and obviously the difference between a novel and the script. The script is a blueprint and a map and a sort of instruction manual, and then you give it to lots of people and they make it real. Whereas this, it's the words I've put down, hopefully creates the images and the people in your head. That's what Stephen King calls that act of magic that happens, because it shouldn't. Some scratchings on a page then make you see a world. It's incredible. And that's also part of why I wanted to write a novel, is just that direct relationship with readers.
The one thing that I think about this quite a lot, so forgive me, it's a sad confession, I do think about this quite a lot. But, crime fiction is so popular, probably the most popular genre form of writing. And I'm going to put something to you. I wondered if it's because it is the insertion in domestic and familiar environments, the extraordinary. You do it very specifically in here. It's the pub. I mean, it couldn't be a more familiar setting, but then you disturb it with a murder, don't you? Is that one of the reasons why we're so drawn to crime? Because it's that disruption of the familiar, do you know?
I think it's that. I think there's many, many things, and I understand why you think that a lot, as I also do. I think it's a manifest. So it's definitely, there is whatever environment you're in, you are dropping a massive boulder into that lake. But also, it is our worst fear. Let's be real, this is why it's important that, for me, and there's an emotional component of it. It also means you're encountering people at their most pressured, vulnerable, emotional, at an extraordinary time. And it's both our worst fear, and also it's inconceivable that this event could happen, but we know that these things happen. So I think there's that, and then obviously, in most things, it's about the restoration of order. You know, that really order is disrupted in the first chapter, and it is, to some extent, restored, but usually with the detective solving the crime. Spoiler, that's what happens in this. There is a satisfaction to that and a reassurance as well.
And do you think that's why crime fiction is ever more popular? Because in a world that's more complicated and more maybe anxiety-provoking, ever more we need that restoration of order, we need that sense of order.
Yeah, it may be. I mean, I don't know. I feel like with all of these things, with the reason why it's so popular and why it's more popular now, I feel like there's always about 17 different reasons that you go, oh, is it that, or is it that, or... I mean, there's also a lot of incredible crime writing as well, and so I think that's a part of it. And I think it satisfies the addictive nature of story consumption, that we as human beings, so I was talking earlier on, we are story addicts as creatures, in a way that apparently, as far as we know, the other animals on the planet are not. but that's what marks us. But why is that? Why do we care? But it is, that's why I wanted to put a pub at the centre of this. There's many reasons the pub is at the centre, but part of that is it should, great. I always feel like a great novel is like the greatest night you have in a pub, where you just want to be in this group of people and hear them talking and have, and that guy's going to be funny, and that guy's going to tell me an extraordinary fact, and that woman's going to go, right, here's just what happened today, or all of those things,
So then there might be a bit of a punch up. Well, that might just be.
Just your pub, isn't it? Yeah.
we know, I think, there's already TV interest.
We're going to make it into. I mean, I'm going to adapt it into a TV series next year.
Was that in your as you were writing that?
It wasn't, and you're not the first to ask me that. And every time this comes up, I'm like, I feel like an idiot for not having considered it. but also, when I was writing it, I really wanted to write it. I really wanted to be sure I was writing it just as a novel. So I've written. So there are lots of things in there that, as I was typing them. I was thinking, well, good luck if anybody has to adapt this, because you can't do that on television, and that's really expensive, and how are you going to have a 9-year-old at the middle of the night, you know? Where are they going to park the trucks when they do that bit? All of that, and that's now going to be my problem.
And it's who you're doing?
I'm going to adapt, yeah, so my company who produced Broadchurch and the upcoming Seven Dials for Netflix, Agatha Christie adaptation, we're producing it with Red Planet Pictures, who make Death in Paradise, amongst others. We're going to do that next year.
We see it next year?
No, we'll film it next year, so it'll likely be on air the year after.
Right, brilliant. I'm going to go to the audience for questions momentarily, but you anticipated really nicely one of my questions, which is the Seven Dials adaptation. What can you tell us about that?
It's a hoot. It's really, I've just been in the picture grade this week and finishing it off, and it's 3 episodes. It will be on Netflix beginning of next year, end of this year, not really sure. It has Martin Freeman, Helena Bonham Carter, Mia McKenna-Bruce as a bundle. It's produced to The Crown, so it's a really nice budget, so stately homes and cars and 1925 London and dance bands and CD clubs. Jokes, lots of great comic actors in there. So funny Christie, it's one of her early ones, and it's got a bit of the P.G. Woodhouse bright young things. It's a thriller as much as it is a murder mystery, so I'm really proud of it. I think it's a really lovely piece, and I hope people like it.
Was it your choice that particular novel for adaptation?
Yeah, so Netflix had got a load of Agatha Christie's novels, had optioned a lot of novels and short stories, and they came to me and said, what do you want to do any of these? And I reread all of that stuff, that was not mature. And that one leapt out. I didn't actually remember it from, and I think I read them all when I was a teen. But I haven't remembered it, and it was just, there's the two great things about it. I mean, there are many great things about it. It's a corporate story. But the central character is this Lady Eileen Brent, who is 1920, she's called Bundle, and she's the protagonist in it. She's really lively and funny, and that's great. And it's also not quite like, and mainly it was just had a real tone of joy and fun, and it's witty, and the characters are funny and odd, and it's got a great story.
Why is Agatha still so popular?
Because she's a brilliant writer, and she's an underestimated writer. When I'm going back and reading all of this, it's like three sentences of Agatha Christie are worth 5 chapters of somebody else's writing, and that makes her. She's so economical, and you will read a page of her and about a character, and you will just know who they are. She's also brilliant at dialogue. I could talk for a long time about her, because I think, despite being the second most popular writer who's ever lived in terms of this, isn't it Shakespeare first and Agatha Christie second? I think she is critically underappreciated. And you talk about, you didn't quite use this phrase, but the social diarist element of being a writer. If you want the story of the 20th century, or at least up until 1977, you read Agatha Christie, and in terms of the sort of British social history from a particular viewpoint, you know, definitely, and that's more sort of, you know, upper middle and upper class. But I think she's a great plotter. Her characters are really indelible, because if you think about those, you know, just the two characters of Poirot and Marple, not any characters at all like Poirot or Marple anywhere else, and everybody's imitated them in different ways. But I think it's entirely justified her popularity.
And it's really good. It's really interesting hearing you talk about it, because
they're overlooked, people are potentially. And even Miss Marple particularly is the sort of woman that you otherwise would overlook, and yet she has this mind
Kind
of loop trap, doesn't she? She's like, she's the most forensic thinker.
Completely, and I think but also that applies to Poirot because he was a Belgian refugee, wasn't he? That's where he starts as a character, and so it's that. But he's always described as funny little man, you know, with an egg-shaped head, and it's like she does everything to lower his status. And both of those people have no status as they walk into a crime scene or a room or a load of suspects or a stately home, and yet they are going. But they notice everything. So. Yeah, you can see, and it's been great. I mean, how amazing to be able to, you know, to have been taking those books out of the library and then to, I was writing the adaptation of Seven Dials as I was writing the first draft of this novel, and to take one apart, go, how are you doing it? How does it work as a kind of Swiss watch? And was lovely.
So much to talk about. But let's open up to questions from the audience. So, yes, there's a young and rather beautiful one there.
Thank you, Tim.
Just grab my microphone.
Oh, right, okay.
I wasn't expecting the microphone.
Chris, for me, Broadchurch was exactly the right drama at exactly the right time, and arguably on exactly the right channel. And the idea of a terrible incident and the impact that that has on a community, for me at the time, it was very reminiscent of what was going on in the Nordic noir, you know, the killing, the bridge, Borgen, that kind of, those stories. And I wonder, was that something that influenced you, or did you just have the same brilliant idea at the same time?
It's what it influenced was the commissioning, to be honest. Is what it made, what those BBC Four, the success when they were on BBC Four of Killing and Bridge and all of those. You have ideas that kind of people aren't interested in making, and then suddenly something changes, or somebody's willing to take a risk, and then you're like, oh, I've got that. You know, that's the thing I've been wanting to do since. You know. So I had my first show was a Sunday night show, sort of all creatures, great small touch show called Born of Bread. Four seasons, set in a village in Lancashire, family drama, sort of comedy drama, very cosy. And coming out of that, I really wanted to do a sort of more crackery Edge of Darkness whodunit set in a village. So it had always been in my head, and then there was a certain point when that became. It was present, but although even as I'm saying that, I'm thinking, well, this isn't, it's so much more about seven different things that kind of had to align, one of which was, I mean, it was a massive risk for ITV because they hadn't done an eight-part serialised drama ever, and everything was sort of one story per week and then done, so it was a big risk, but one of the reasons they said yes to, and I had written it on spec for myself after I had a really horrible experience on the show I'd done previously, and it's like, actually, I just want to write something for myself. So I wrote that first episode for myself, and then thought, oh, I'll show this to somebody. But the reason it got greenlit is that another show went down, and they had an 8-week gap in the ITV schedule. They were like, can you deliver it by next March? And this is sort of more in January, and I've written one episode. I was like, yes, we absolutely can. Thinking, oh, there is no way we can do this. It was the right channel at the right time for us. But you're right, I think it being on ITV and being the first one, and now everything's 8 episodes. Literally nothing, if you look, like, there was stuff out. Somebody said, oh, the last time anybody done an 8 episode drama before that was Our Friends in the North, which is one of the great dramas. And I was like, don't tell me that. So definitely the Nordic influence, it helped the commissioners feel good about it.
Right.
And I guess it was in the ether as well. So yeah, it was.
It deserves its place. It definitely deserves its place. And,
thank you. Yeah. I mean, we love doing it.
Absolutely brilliant.
Thank you.
Thank you, Martin. Next question. Yes, sir.
Firstly, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
Secondly, as you can see, Doctor Who fan here.
Yeah, I would never have guessed.
No, definitely.
And on a very close, humid day as well, so well done for wearing the jumper.
You should see me in cosplay when I do the full everything on a hot day. Anyway, as a writer, how difficult is it to stay true to what you see as the future of a show when you've got a fan base as big as Doctor Who bearing at you from all angles? Is it difficult or...?
No. It's, well, I mean, it can be. You have to make a decision, I think, when you do anything. So it's also true if I'm adapting, you know, Christie or something like that, you're aware that there are people invested. But I think if you are, so with something like Doctor Who, if you're going into and working on that, my job is to go in there with a vision, and the people who are in charge of the BBC and drama and you know, who are making Doctor Who, they want that vision, so they are, you know, buying that vision off me. My job is then to deliver that vision. Now, if along the way some people get cross about that vision, I think we can now say in this age of multiple IP, there are elements of every fandom of pre-existing IP, whether that be Star Wars or whatever, that when you do something different or new, they are unhappy about it. So, but that doesn't mean it's the wrong thing to do. So, no, my job is to go in. I was really clear about what I was going to do. They wanted me to do that. We did that thing. I'm really proud of what we did.
You've got to challenge people, because otherwise it just stays the same.
Well, but then also people aren't necessarily happy if things stay the same as well. And it's, you know, taking on a job like that, that if you are thinking about a particular sector's response to it, you're not going to win, because also fandoms are not monoliths. There are huge divides within fandom. You know, some people like, basically, you can shrink it down to, some people will like what you're going to do, some people won't. That's really the story of everybody doing any kind of new version of whatever. And so you have to think, is it right for the time? Do I believe that it's right? We cast Jodie Whittaker as the first female Doctor. 1,000,000%. I'm only more certain today. You know, is it right we did all the things we did, the historical stories or whatever? Yeah, I think it is. You know, you go in, you go, we'll give it a go, we'll do the thing, and we're going, and it is the most joyous job you can possibly have. You know, working on something that you love as a kid, and then going, I get to choose what the inside of a TARDIS looks like. Amazing. You know, how many people get to say that? I get to choose what a monster looks like. People send me in a WhatsApp group, they go, how many human teeth would you like on the face of this alien that you've said has a face of human teeth? What a great job. And it's like, but you also go in on something, and I don't say that as a blasé way, it's just like, my job is not to be affected by the sort of crosswinds. You have to tell the story the same way with the novel. It's like, my job is to write a novel that I believe in, and I can come out and go, this is the story I wanted to tell. You know, some people will buy it and love it. It's doing very well, 4.3 on Amazon, over 500 reviews, guys, come on. And then, you know, obviously, you know, somebody might not like it, and it's like, but that's not really, you're not writing for the people who don't need the story, you're writing for the people who need that version, or want that version, and might get something out of it. And the bonus thing on Doctor Who, and then I'll shut up talking, is, you know, there is a 7-year-old for whom it's the first time they watch the show, and that Doctor is their first Doctor, and they will remember it all their lives. And that's the joy of it every day. And that's the thing you keep in your head.
Thank you. Great question.
Yeah, thank you.
Next question. Yes, there's one here, then we'll come to you in a bit.
Hello. Bit of a selfish question, so sorry, everyone.
Interesting.
I'm coming up to my end of time at uni now. I'm doing a master's in script writing, and I think it's kind of, you know, it's all laid out for you. You've got school, and you've got college, and you've got university, and it's got this kind of ominous thing. You just have no idea what you're sort of meant to do with that. So as I'm coming up so close, I just kind of want to know what your advice would be to me, or just sort of anyone in that position trying to get into the sort of TV industry. Is kind of basically what I want to be doing, fingers crossed. So I suppose that's my question.
No, that's not a selfish question. That's a wonderful question. Thank you for asking it. I think, number one, if you really want to do it, and it sounds like you do, and you've been directing your life towards it, it's like, okay, then you can do it. I didn't know anybody, and like, you know, my dad worked for his life for an insurance company. I didn't know anybody other than, you know, knowing that the writer was possibly a job, you know. So there is there's in many ways no barrier to entry. The sort of barrier to entry is, and this is good and bad news, your persistence. And number one, I'd say believe in yourself. And also, if you've got onto a course, if you're still on that course and you're going to graduate with a degree in that, you're clearly really good at it. So that's number two. What are we on? Number one, number two. So you take that validation, hold it really close, and keep holding on to it for the next 30 years, because people have said you can do this, and that's really important. That's not nothing. Then the thing is, don't be downhearted as you go through. Think it might take time. Then, in terms of script writing, I think if you can get your work performed or made, and the great news now is you can make short films yourself on your phone nowadays, and you can upload them to YouTube. And when I was like, you couldn't, that was a dream. So making short films, like, I would say, write lots of stuff, make it, and edit it. If you want to direct it yourself, you can do that, because there's no mystique to that. And learn each time you do it. Every time you make something, you will learn the things you got wrong. Trust me, and most of mine have been on BBC One. It's Android TV. So there's that. So keep doing that. Make that, or if you want to do scripts, then also local theatres or write plays or write audio dramas and get some mates to make. You probably know people from uni or just, you know. So there's loads of ways you can do it yourself. So don't be stopped in making things and learn from those, and then pester people. And if you, it's like, just keep sending people things, keep making things. It took me, and I don't say this to be disheartening, because I'm not saying this is everybody's journey, but it took me like 10 years until I first got paid to write. I first got paid when I was like 29, and I've been trying to, I've been writing since I was writing. I did my degree, I wrote plays, and but since I graduated, so it's probably 8 years after I left uni, then I got it. But I think, and then try and write to, if you need to get an agent, write to agents who represent writers you like. Come to all these things, ask those questions, but it's like, it's doable. It's not easy, but loads of people do it, and it's an amazing job.
Great.
So good luck.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you for the question.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi Chris, I was wondering, given on Doctor Who you had this sort of parallel between Yaz going into the police force because she wants to do good but ultimately leaving, and the future of Doctor being in the Division and being sort of implied to have left for the same reasons, is it fair to say that your work kind of sometimes takes a fascination with people who go into organisations wanting to do good but then questioning whether or not that's right, and to what degree do you think,
I've never thought about it like that, so it's a good question.
To what degree do you think that's influenced by one of your greatest influences that you bring up, The Prisoner?
Do you want to sit here and answer the question? Because I think you've thought about it very thoroughly. And you do wear your influences. I think, is that a metaphor for life? It's like, are we all trying to do our best in a world which is sometimes against us, or sometimes institutions frustrate us, or you know, our daily lives are the oppositional force to our hope for ourselves and for others. So I wonder if that's quite a universal sort. Certainly, I'm interested in people trying to do their best, and then by the very nature of the setup of a story, they're usually jostling with a force who's frustrating that. But I haven't thought of it like that. But yeah, I mean, you're right, The Prisoner is a big influence too. So, yeah, possibly. Very good question. Questions are very good in Bath.
Very good.
Yeah.
We have time for one more question. So, this is a new burden question. Yes, sir.
Hi. It's very sad, I think, that a lot of what you're best known for is sort of genre material, you know, crime, Broadchurch, and Doctor Who, Torchwood, you know, sci-fi. My favourite thing that you've actually written is something well outside that. It's actually United. And it sort of gets overlooked quite a lot in your sort of canon. And I was just wondering about that. What brought you to that project? I mean, I'm a big United fan, so I went into it with a bit of trepidation, thinking, yep. Oh, this needs to be done right. And I was wondering what brought you to that project, if you did a lot of research for it, if you're a football fan, if you maybe like even interviewed some of the survivors at that time, and just how it all came together.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. And it's on iPlayer for anybody who uses a loose end over the bank holiday weekend, still there. I'm really proud of it. Thank you for raising it. You're right, yeah. And actually that and the Great Train Robbery, two films that I wrote for BBC One. Really, I love doing both those projects. United, yeah, so number one, hang on, let's try and get through these questions. Number one, yes, I am a football fan. I have to break it to you, I'm a Liverpool fan. That will be tomorrow for me. A lot of the people who worked on that project were football fans. There weren't many Man U fans. But one of the things, so it came about through Torchwood, the director James Strong, who then went on to direct Broadchurch, had been wanting to make a film about the Busby Babes and the Munich air crash for a long time. And he had, over a number of years, talked to all of the survivors who were alive at that time and many of the family members. So jumping forward at the end, so to your question about, so a lot of it was on primary evidence. He'd been and talked to Harry Gregg, the book, who you will know, you know, all of those people. And we had worked together on Torchwood, and he knew I was a football fan, and we got to talking about it. And for me, the big thing is, with that, I was amazed that there had never been a dramatisation of it. Because I think sometimes we're, as the sort of filmmaking culture in this country, we don't mythologise a lot of our own big social history moments in a way that America does. Like if that was an American incident, there would be seven films of that, you know. A lot of that is there's not, television has always been very reluctant to do dramas about football. For some reason, it's a little less true now, but definitely that was the case. So we had a lot of primary material. I read all of that. We talked to a lot of people, and I went. I mean, I've still got the bookshelf of every single book. You know, I found Jeannie Murphy's autobiography, like that I didn't even know existed. All of that kind of stuff. Went through all of that, and we just got a team together who really believed in that story. We talked to the families and did it. And the thing, it was the team on that were very passionate about doing it. It was very low budget, and one of the most emotional days in my career has been the day we screened that at the Corner House in Manchester for all. So for everyone involved who was alive or relatives and children of people who, you know, and grandchildren. That was an incredible, it was a kind of, I don't want to say a beautiful day, but it was an incredible experience and I'm really proud of the film. I feel like I've rambled across that answer, but I'm really glad you brought it up because it's, yeah.
That's a great last question. Thank you. It just demonstrates the breadth of Chris's work, so thank you so much. Sadly, time has beaten us. I'll conclude with some remarks in a moment, but just to say, if you want to, and you should do, if you want to get the book, it can be bought at the back, and Chris will be signing it. If you're going to buy a book, just hang back, let the other people leave first. But the thing I want to say most of all is thank you, Chris. Book festivals, literary festivals, if they're anything, they're celebrations of stories and reading and writers. And, you know, Chris is one of the most outstanding writers of his generation on television. But now I think you'll see when you read this book, you'll find when you read this book, it's a fine novel. It takes a genre, but does something really good and special with it. And as you say, these are this is the commentary, historical record of our day, but done in a really gripping, exciting, page-turning way. So thank you so much for giving this to me.
Thank you. Listen, thank you, and thank you for such a great interview and really lovely questions. And for being here, guys, thank you.
Can we say thank you? Thank you.